introduce myself. My name is Gina Butz. I'm on staff with Crew at our headquarters in Orlando. I serve on the Global Digital Strategies team doing mostly leadership development. One of the things I really enjoy doing is teaching people about the Enneagram. I've done it for a number of teams at our headquarters, as well as a few other campus and regional teams from other parts of the U.S. And I'm so, like, this warms my heart so much to see all of you here, because I have known about and studied the Enneagram for over 9 years, and for the longest time, nobody else really knew about it, so I was really sad, and I had no one to talk to. And it's like all of you just showed up to my party, and now we can all talk about it. I'm so excited. But seriously, I am excited, because what I'm most passionate about in ministry is seeing people being really awake and wholehearted and free. And for me, in my own journey in those things, God has used the Enneagram in a really powerful way in my own personal and spiritual growth, as well as understanding the people in my life and being able to communicate with them in a way that is full of grace and compassion. So how many of you, I'm just curious, how many of you are already familiar with the Enneagram? Okay, why are we even doing this then? How many of you think that it's like you're confident, I know what type I am? Okay, great. How many of you, like, you're like, my friend said I have to know about the Enneagram, so that's why I'm here. Okay, yeah. So briefly, the Enneagram is a personality assessment that asserts that we are one of 9 core numbers. There's a lot of variation between it within those numbers, and there are ways that we are connected to other numbers that I'm going to talk about as we go. But basically, the Enneagram says that each of these different numbers has a lens through which they see the world. I like the Enneagram over any other personality assessment. Don't ask me what I am on the Myers-Briggs, because I can't even tell you. Oh, yay, there I am. Am I still in the... Where is, okay, good. Yes. Okay. You guys, can you hear me better now? Okay, great. Enough to yell. But the Enneagram, I think, is unique as opposed to other assessments, because it doesn't just tell you what you do, it tells you why you do it. It's not just about behavior, it's about motivation. And if we really want to see change at a heart level, we have to know what drives me. What am I trying to get? Why do I do this? It's also unique in that it doesn't just tell you where you are. It's not a static assessment. Even though you're always going to be the same number, the Enneagram helps you see, how did I get here? And where does God want to take me? What's the vision for the true self that he has created me to be? So my hope for today is simply to introduce this idea to you, to help you see the value of the Enneagram and how you can use it and pursue it as a tool for personal growth. So just briefly, I don't have notes. I anticipated a lot of people coming. So if you go to this is my website, ginabutz.com. If you go to /Enneagram, there is a page there. There's a link on that page that says Enneagram Quick Reference Guide. If you click on that, that's going to give you the bulk of what I have up here. So you guys don't have to try and write down everything. You can just be scrolling through and you can write down like what I say that's not included. Is it seriously?
Not that page, but the reference guide.
Okay, I will relink that. Okay, I don't know why that. Can you fix that one?
It works on mine.
Does it?
Well, did you click the link?
No.
Click on the link. Oh, okay. Let me just. Can I do that really quick? I don't know if I can. Okay, I will fix that, you guys. But they can't follow along with in the book. It must be sad. Okay, you work on it. That's my husband. I think
just be voluntold.
Okay. All right. Well, otherwise you can screenshot it. Okay. But then you can download it later and you can see it. I'm so sorry. Okay. So let me tell you briefly how I came to understand the Enneagram. About 9 years ago, I was coaching a leadership development program that we did overseas, and the other coaches started pulling out these Enneagram books. So I was interested, and they had this one in particular, The Wisdom of the Enneagram. So I scrolled through it, and I decided, okay, I'm probably a 1, a 3, or a 4. One of the other coaches is this very wise woman named Iris, and she said, she's a three. And she said, Gina, I think you're probably a three. And I said, yeah, but there's things about a three that I feel like aren't true about me. And in my mind, and I was like, and I really don't want to be a three. So I got a couple more books, and I started reading through the different types. And I came to the conclusion that I'm an Enneagram one. So I texted Iris, Iris, I'm a one. And she texted back, if you say so. Okay, Iris doesn't believe me. So I kept reading, and I had a couple more really revealing conversations with people who know me well. And I came to the conclusion that I am, in fact, an Enneagram 3. Yeah. So I called Iris in tears. Because the news was devastating to me. I called her, I was like, Iris, I'm a 3. And she said, oh, honey, I know. She said, Gina, when I learned I was a 3, I was up all night. And in the morning, I thought, if I'm a 3, it's because God made me a 3, and that's a good thing. I was like, okay. So, you're probably thinking, what's wrong with being a 3? Nothing. 3s are awesome. I love being a 3 now. But I tell you that story to illustrate a few things I think are important to understand about the Enneagram. First of all, it can be hard to identify your type. This isn't like a BuzzFeed quiz that you take, like which Disney prince or princess are you? Even if you take a test online, those are not conclusive, okay? That's just to give you an idea of what you might be. But it took me 3 or 4 times of revisiting the material to know what I was. Because like I said, it's not about behavior. It's one thing to be like, oh yeah, that's what I do. But ask me why I do it. I don't know why I do it. So I want to encourage you as we go through the individual types to listen not for behavior, but to listen to the core things, the core need, the core fear, and the root sin. Yeah, we get to talk about our sin today. Super fun. The second thing is that nobody is going to read a description of their number and agree with all of it and be like, yep, totally, to a T. The reason why I didn't think I was a 3 is because there are things that are true about a 3 that are not true about me, right? But the thing is, the root things, the motivation of a 3, that's mine. How I live it out might be a little different than how other 3s live it out. The third thing is, when you're trying to figure out what Enneagram type you are, it's the one you don't want to be. It absolutely is. The one that makes you cringe. And here's why. Because it gets at our depravity. It helps us see our shadow side. I didn't want the depravity of a 3 to be my depravity. I wanted it to be something else because I know how that depravity hurts me and hurts other people. I know how it separates me from God. But here's the thing. If we don't own our depravity, we don't get to see redemption, right? So I want to be somebody who's willing to own that, to willing to say, yes, I'm willing to see what I do that I don't want to do. And the fourth thing is, whatever number you are is what God made you to be, and he loves it. He delights in it. He would have you no other way, okay? Because here's what I've found for myself and for other people is that when we start to understand our Enneagram type, there's a contempt that can come that we're like, oh, that's what I do. Ugh, yuck. And God says, but you know what? I've always known that about you, and I've always loved you, okay? So it is a good thing. So I'm going to talk briefly about the Enneagram in general. Yeah, Carson.
If you want to get the PDF, just Google the file.
Yeah.
Then you'll pull it up.
Thank you. What is the file?
So when you went to your link,
yes.
In the URL, it said Enneagram guide, whatever
yeah.
it is.
Yes. That's kind of scary that you can just get it that way.
Enneagram-quick-reference-guide.
I love like people who can do such dash.pdf.
That's what it says.
Okay. Obviously created by someone who doesn't do tech stuff. Sorry, guys. So I'm going to talk about the Enneagram briefly, and we're going to talk through the different numbers. So, but at any point, if you have a question, you can ask. But I am going to stop and like give you space for questions. So don't feel like, oh, when am I going to ask a question? And then hopefully we'll have some time at the end as well. Okay, so I want to talk about this first. This diagram is also on the page that I sent you to. This is how we're meant to live, guys. We're meant to live out of a foundation of the love of God. And out of that would flow our love for others. Out of that would flow the tasks to which God has called us. The reality is that most of us live like this. We live like this because we are sinners who are hardwired to save ourselves. So we figure out ways to find life and love apart from him in order to do the tasks to which he's called us to do. We haven't grounded ourselves in his love and our identity in him. And the reality is, my friend Dave would tell me that we come by these strategies honestly, right? We come by them honestly. We develop them in response to fundamental identity questions that we're all asking. As we grow up, we're asking these questions of the world. What's my place in this world? What role gives me significance? How do I find love and belonging? How do I avoid pain? So we develop these strategies to answer these questions, and we find answers to those questions in relationship with parents, with our families, with teachers, with friends, from life experience. And there are messages that we internalize and messages that we don't internalize, that we should internalize about who God says we are, that help us to answer these questions of what does it take for me to survive and be happy? So if I were to ask you, what role did you play in your family growing up? You might tell me, well, I was the good kid, or I was the funny kid. I was the strong one, or I was the rebel. I was the helpful one. And those roles that we develop in our family of origin are roles that we carry into our adult lives. They are what make life work. And there's something that's good about those roles. They're part of how God has created us. But the reality is when the energy behind those roles is self-protective or self-promotional, then it's not from this center. It's from this pillar of our old self. And I think the value of the Enneagram is that it can help us identify what are those things that I do and why do I do them? What lies am I believing? What truth do I need to hear? How am I trying to save myself? Ephesians 4:22 to 24 says, "You were taught with regard to your former way of life to put off your old self, which is being corrupted by its deceitful desires, to be made new in the attitude of your minds, to put on the new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness." So to put off the old self, we have to know it. If we are unaware of these strategies of our old self, the idols that we have, they become our prison. They become things that we feel compelled to do. Like, I have to be the good person to survive. I have to be a peaceful person. I can't rock the boat. I have to be the strong one in order to survive. Instead of learning to rest in him for life and love. So here's the thing. As we grow and we try to leave behind our old self, our behavior doesn't radically change. I'm a three. We're performers. I will always be a performer. But the question is, will I do it to get life and to get love from other people? Or will I do it out of an overflow of what he's given me? There's a freedom that's found in the latter. And that's the kind of awareness that I hope the Enneagram can give to us. A lot of you are familiar with one of the more recent Enneagram books, The Road Back to You. There's a quote in here, they say, "As long as we stay in the dark about how we see the world and the wounds and beliefs that have shaped who we are prisoners of our history. We'll continue going through life on autopilot, doing things that hurt and confuse ourselves and everyone around us. Eventually, we become so accustomed to making the same mistakes over and over in our lives that they lull us to sleep. We need to wake up." So my hope is that we would be people who are awake to what we do and why we do it, so that we can live in the freedom and the rest that God calls us to live, to people who give out of an overflow. So let's take a look at the Enneagram in general, this decidedly creepy-looking circle. And a couple things I want to make clear about the Enneagram. One of them is a very common misconception. Here's the thing. You are one number on the Enneagram. Okay? A lot of people come to me and they'll be like, "Oh, I love the Enneagram. I'm a 2 and a 7. No, that's not how the Enneagram works. Okay? If you resonate with other numbers, and you probably will, there's another reason for that. Okay? But the way that the Enneagram works, and I didn't make this rule, but So I understand it as you are one number. So why would you resonate with something other than your own number? Well, one of the primary reasons is that you would have something that's called a wing. And that's the number to either side of your number. So as a 3, I can have a 2 wing, or I can have a 4 wing. I happen to have a very strong 4 wing, which is why whenever I would read through descriptions of the Enneagram, I would go, oh, 3, no, wait, maybe 4. No, wings. You know, I would just go back and forth for the longest time. So what does that mean, to have a wing? It just means that you identify to some extent with that number to either side of you. And a 3 with a 4 wing is going to look really different than a 3 with a 2 wing. So you start to see where there's a lot of uniqueness even within numbers. But what about that? So sometimes people will say, oh, okay, so I'm not a 2 and a 7. I'm a 2 with a 7 wing. Like, no. See, this is how biology works. Your wings are attached to your body, right? If your wing is out there at a 7, then you're dead. Because you can't, that's not, right? So why would somebody say that they're a 2, but they also say they're a 7? Well, there's a lot of reasons. Maybe you really want to be a 7. Right? Maybe you're a 2, but you really want to be a 7. If you really want to be a number, guys, I'm so sorry, but you're probably not that number. Okay? It might be that you were raised by a 7, and that voice is still really strong in your head, especially if you're young. I think part of the reason why I resonate so much with 1 is both my parents, my dad is a 9 with a 1 wing, and my mom is a 2 with a 1 wing, so that 1 presence in my life is really strong. It might be that you have strengths or spiritual gifts that are indicative of a different number. I have a good friend, actually she's here, who's a 5, but her top strength is harmony. So, of course, she resonates with peacemaker, right? So you might have leadership as one of your top gifts. So you're going to resonate with 8. That doesn't necessarily mean you're an 8. So I encourage you as I go through again, pay attention to the core need, the core fear, and the root sin, all right? And the one that you resonate with the most of those is probably what you are. The other thing that can make you feel like you have a connection to another number is these different lines. I'm not going to get into it too much today just because of time, but on that quick guide, the reference guide, I did list out the 2 numbers that each number is connected to. So I'll just give you an example. What these represent is called your line of integration and disintegration. So your line of integration is what happens when you're feeling secure, when you're feeling mature and you're growing and you're healthy. You can take on some of the positive traits of your number, your direction of integration. So example, I'm 3. My direction of integration is towards 6. So when I'm mature and I'm healthy and I'm growing, I can take on some of the positive traits of a 6. That doesn't mean I don't become a 6. But it just means my lens isn't quite so narrow. I can be more expansive in my behavior. Conversely, your direction of disintegration is what happens when you're under prolonged stress for an extended period of time. So if you happen to be looking at the Enneagram for the first time when you're in a really, really tough season, you might identify with your direction of disintegration. So for me as a 3, I have my direction of disintegration is 9. When we moved back to the States from 13 years overseas, I disintegrated a little bit, and I started recognizing some of the negative traits of a 9 for some periods of time in my life. And that to me is a good red flag, like something's wrong when I start to see those traits, because they're very very unusual for a 3 to act like a negative 9. I start to get really apathetic and unproductive and I don't want to do anything. So like I said, I'm not going to go through those, but you can look at those later and see what that looks like for you. There's also different levels of maturity. Each number has 9 levels of maturity according to the wisdom of the Enneagram. And it's really a reflection of the higher you are is really a reflection of your ability to be self-aware. And I would say from a Christian perspective, the degree to which you are resting in God, you are going to grow in maturity. As we move down in maturity, it's generally because we're being reactive and defensive. So the negative traits are us being reactive and defensive. Before we go on, I want to caution you on 2 things. I would caution you not to too quickly or too flippantly Enneagram type other people, right? Because it is presumptuous of us to think that we know what drives someone at a heart level, right? And also, the Enneagram really shows us at our most vulnerable. So for us to just, you know, oh, you're this, you're that. So when people ask me, what number do you think I am? Even if I feel like I have a good idea, I'll generally say, well, I wonder if you might be a 7. I wonder if you might be a 2. I could be wrong. I see some of that in you. The second thing is, I would caution you not to weaponize the Enneagram. Our team is familiar with it. I've done it for our team at headquarters. And so we know it about each other. And so we'll joke sometimes, oh, Rich, that's because you're 7. We'll joke about those things. But like I said, this is really can show us at our most vulnerable. And that's something that we have to hold sacred. We have to hold with a lot of grace and compassion, right? Because we want it to be something that draws us closer to each other, helps us understand and enter into each other's stories and each other's growth more. All right, so before I move on to the individual numbers, are there any questions? Yeah.
Is there any particular correlation that 3, 6, and 9 make a diamond and all the others connect to each other?
I don't know why that's true.
Okay.
The other way is not a very easy to explain pattern. It's just kind of, yeah. Any other questions?
The link on the website's back up. If you search on that one, it brings you to a different one that kind of has like a green color to it.
Yeah.
A different reference guide, probably also helpful, but different. But different than the one that Gina is referring to is
okay.
Now linked.
Don't go there.
Over there. You shouldn't get a 404 error anymore.
Okay.
I got one more, sorry.
Yes,
I got
another question. Yeah.
What would you say are the best tools to be able to assess yourself?
I'm going to get to that at the end.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on. Let's move to number one. Okay, so we're talking about number one. Number ones are called the reformers, also known as the perfectionists, activists, and teachers. So like I said, each number has a root need, and the root need for a one is to be good, to be right, to be beyond criticism. It's really a need to be perfect. There's a basic fear of being corrupt or evil, of making mistakes, and like I said, this is the material that's gonna be on it's on that guide, so you don't have to try and furiously write it all down. So the lens that Enneagram ones have is that you are loved and accepted when you are perfect, good, and do what's right. But they believe that the world is full of error, and they are duty-bound to correct it. That the world judges those who don't follow the rules. So they can be very hard on themselves and hard on others, but they don't see it that way. They just feel like that's what you have to do to survive. They become standard bearers for what should be. And their focus is on what is wrong with them and the world. So at their best. Now when I say at their best, what I mean is this is the authentic self that God intended for ones to be. This is a reflection of a part of who God is because God is good, right? So at their best, wise, discerning, conscientious, high integrity, strong convictions, they make personal sacrifices for the greater good, teachers, crusaders, advocates for change. At their worst, like I said, this is lower levels of maturity, when they're being reactive and defensive, hypercritical of self and others, judgmental, impatient, perfectionistic, have a constant inner critic that polices them. And one of the things that I tell ones who are Christians is that inner critic, a lot of times they think that's God's voice. And if that voice is harsh and critical and condemning, that is not God, that's you. And I know that for ones, it's a helpful practice to learn how to dialogue with that inner voice. Our daughter is a one, and she has named her inner critic Marty because she said, boys are mean. It has to be a boy's name because boys are mean. So she plays soccer, and a lot of times on the soccer field, Marty starts working overtime. She shouldn't have done that. That was a mistake. That was wrong. You know, she starts kind of causing her to self-doubt. And so she's learned to say, you know what, Marty, we're going to put a pin in it. We're going to talk about this later. And you know what? In the practice of that, it's become quieter. So that's a good practice for ones. So the root sin, each number has a root sin, and this is not the only sin, this is not the only way that ones sin, but it's really kind of their Achilles heel. And it comes from trying to satisfy protect themselves from their root fear and their own strength. It comes from trying to save themselves. And the root sin for them is resentment. Because ones have a standard of performance that applies to everyone. And they are doing their best to meet it. And you are not. And that is not fair. So the path of growth for ones is peace, and I would also add grace. The path of growth really forces us to address ourselves at our most vulnerable. And for a one to be at peace is to say, you know what, I am actually not perfect. And that's okay. And I can still be loved if I'm not perfect. I don't have to be perfect to be good. And God, when he looks at me, he sees his righteousness, right? So each of us, for our root, we have to look at our root fear and say, how does God speak to that root fear? And that's really a path of growth for each of us. Ones at their best are a reflection of God's goodness and his righteousness. That's how he intended for them to be and to give to the world. So I'm not going to have time to go into the details of this page. I'm giving you some developmental tips and some coaching questions. But I show them to you to remind you that the value of the Enneagram, I feel like, gives us a framework for growth. It's not meant to be static. We can use it to see an intentional path toward greater freedom from our old strategies and greater reliance and rest in the Lord. So if you think you're one or you are one, I would encourage you to screenshot this page. This is not in the guide. But here's the thing. Any Enneagram book that you get is going to have these kind of suggestions. The coaching questions I got from a book called Deep Coaching Using the Enneagram, and that I have a list of references at the end, so you don't have to try and write down any book that I mentioned either. So yeah, these really kind of just get you to question your lens, you know, to think outside the box a little bit. I like what the authors of the Road Back to You say. The Enneagram doesn't put you in a box. It tells you the box you're in and how to get out of it. All right, so before I go on, any questions about ones? Great, this will make it so easy to go through. Okay, yes.
Sorry, Gina.
Sorry, Keith, go ahead.
I wanted to ask you about just a propensity towards judgmentalism, mm-hmm. or how that might show up.
Yeah, well, one thing I can't get into today is there are different ways that the Enneagram's divided into triads, and one of the triads it puts 8, 9, and 1 together in a triad, and one of the things they struggle with is anger. And so for ones, anger is kind of one of those emotions that's maybe not acceptable that good people don't have. And so judgment, sarcasm, criticism, they're kind of passive ways of being angry. So that's ones tend to think very black and white. So the judgment is sort of, you know, I want justice. I want justice in the world. So they kind of set themselves up as judge. And particularly trying to make sure that other people don't judge them. Like they're going to catch themselves before other people can judge and police them. Does that answer your question, Pete?
Yes.
Okay, great. Any other questions about one?
Yes. Does this teacher come out?
Well, I think that because ones, they see the injustices of the world, and so they want to be the people to help kind of bring about that change. So I did this for the teachers at our school. It was funny, like half of them were ones. It was really fascinating. So I think there's just a desire to like make sure that other people are on the right path. I think that's probably part of the motivation. Okay, if you think of things later, we can come back and ask more questions. So type twos are the helpers, caretakers, pleasers, friends, enablers. That are need to be liked or needed. Because there's a basic fear of being unwanted and unworthy of being loved. So their lens is that they are loved and esteemed if they care for others without regard to their own needs. They believe that you have to give in order to get. And they can find it really hard to put a cap on the time and energy that they give to others. Feeling out of gas can be a really frightening feeling for a two because they feel like they can't give, and if they can't give, then people will be disappointed. So at their best, again, this is how God intended for them to be. Unselfish, altruistic, unconditional love for others, friendly, generous, helpful, considerate, empathetic. At their worst, they manipulate others to get love, over-involved to the point of exhaustion, repress their own needs, possessive of others, play the martyr, poor boundaries. So the root sin of a two is pride, which is really, it feels ironic because they're such selfless, such giving people. But here's the thing, it's prideful to say, I will meet your needs, but you will not meet mine. Right? They start to believe in the myth of their own indispensability. And actually, twos, they learn to suppress their needs so much that actually it's really hard for them to tell you what they need. So the path of growth for them is humility. And humility says, I'm going to own exactly how much I'm human. I'm going to own what is true for me. And that means owning my needs. And again, that's a really vulnerable thing for twos because it speaks to that fear of being not worthy of a certain space. So if I'm a two and I come to you and I say, this is what I need, what I'm saying is I'm worthy of time and energy from you. And that's a really fearful thing. Like, what if I'm going to be rejected? So twos need to hear that they are wanted apart from what they do. And it blesses others. Let me tell you, my mom is a two. Some of my best friends are twos. And it blesses me so much when they tell me what they need and I can finally give back to them. And here's the thing, when you think about the root fear of a two, God says you're worthy. You're worthy, you're worth dying for, right? There's no greater proof of your worth. And I think it's really important for twos to dwell on that truth and really let it sink in. So twos at their best are a reflection of God's love and his care for us. So again, some tips, some coaching questions that you can screenshot if you want to. There's lots more of these that you can find in different places. These are just a suggestion. And these are things like if you know this about someone, these are questions you can ask yourself. These are questions that other people can ask you just as a way to enter in and encourage you. So any questions about twos? Yeah.
I read on a website that as a woman, if you get a two, you might be more likely to the second thing you get. Is that true?
It's very true. I think it's true that Christians tend to think that they're twos when they're not, and Christian women in particular, and Christian women in ministry especially, think that they are twos, but they're not twos. So here's the thing. If you read the description of a two and you're like, this is awesome, I sound like Jesus, then you're not a two. Everybody that I know who is a two says to me, can I please be some other number? Maybe I'm a six, you know, maybe I'm something else, right? Because they see, they're like, yes, that, and guys, twos are just as depraved as the rest of us, right? It's a lot of the behavior of a two is what's expected of us as believers, right? We're supposed to be giving, we're supposed to know the needs of others, we're supposed to be unconditionally loving. But the question is, yeah, thank you. The question is, do you do it out of a compulsive need for people to like you? Right? And can you say, well, I don't have to do this. I don't mind helping you, but if I don't, I don't think that you're going to hate me. Yeah, it's very common for people. I think if you find yourself resonating with a number and one of them is two, yeah, I would question it. Unless you're like, please tell me I'm not a two, then you're probably two. Other questions about two? Yeah.
Can you repeat the question?
How does the manipulation come out as a two? I think there's sort of a guilt. The thing about that I've noticed about twos don't ask for appreciation, but they really want it. I'm trying to think, because my mother's a two, and I'm like, gosh, I don't want to think of an example of my mom, because I don't want to throw her on the bus. I'm thinking of a different person in my life who's a very unhealthy two. She gives gifts to everyone every time she sees them, and it feels like you feel like you're always in her debt. It's just, you can never pay her back, and she does it to like get you to like her. And so it's hard to appreciate because it's like I've enough already. Like I like you, okay? It's okay. So I think there's a manipulation that can happen with what they do for you. Like I'll do all this for you, so now you're in my debt. Really unhealthy twos are just trying to get people in their debt. Yeah.
Which is the direction for integration and disintegration?
For a two, twos, when they're healthy, they integrate to four, and they can be more creative, and they can like be more expressive. Disintegration is towards eight, and they take on the unhealthy side of an eight, and they become a lot more demanding.
So that was that way left integration.
Right? It's not a good pattern. In the guide, I for each number, I say which one is integration and disintegration. Yeah. It is being recorded. Yes. All right.
For better quality control.
Better quality
control.
For two.
Why are you recording?
I'm not. Yeah, this is.
Never mind.
Yeah, they can cut stuff out. All the things that I say that's inappropriate. So let's move on to threes. The achievers, performers, status seekers, role models. I actually prefer the word performer for threes, just because when people hear the word achiever, they're like, oh, I'm an achiever. I must be a three. But lots of numbers achieve. Ones, super high achievers. Twos, super high achievers. The question is, why are you doing it, right? And for threes, they're playing a role. It's not just about getting a lot done, but it's about being the best at it. and being impressive. So so the root need is to be valuable, worthwhile, successful. They want to be winners. My husband calls it, they need to be awesome. There's a basic fear of being worthless and not loved for who they are. So the lens through which they see the world is that you are loved and respected if you perform well and accomplish much. They believe that they're only as loved as their last success. They give the appearance of having, these are the people who look like they have it all together. They care about efficiency and productivity because then they can get more done, and they avoid failure at all costs. So at their best, self-accepting, authentic, resilient, charming, ambitious, competent, energetic, nothing to prove, role models who inspire others. At their worst, vain, deceitful, out of touch with their feelings, image conscious, workaholics, overly competitive, too concerned with what others think, and driven. I always love leaving like a list of my faults out to other people. So the root sin of a three is deceit. It's about they're chameleons, they're shapeshifters. They're able to read others and know what those other people expect from them and then be that. So they can kind of put parts of themselves to the side, hide parts of themselves that are less acceptable, that are not as impressive. So I mentioned earlier that I had a hard time accepting that I'm a three. One of the reasons is because I saw that threes are competitive, and I was like, well, I'm not competitive. My friend Colin's like, Colin's played games with me. So I was like, I'm not competitive. So then I told a friend of mine, she burst out laughing. She was like, Gina, you're so competitive. I was like, okay, tell me what you see. So she explained it to me. And what I realized is this. I grew up in a family where being competitive was negatively valued. My mom's a two, right? So you're playing cards with her. She's like, oh, you need a five? Here, have my five. Like, that's not how the game works, mom. Right? So I'm like, you know my cards? I want to win, right? So I downplayed that in myself to the point where I literally deceived myself into thinking that that wasn't true about me. And threes are actually, in some ways, they deceive themselves more than anyone else. Because they're just trying to put forth the best thing, the best image, so that people are going to think that they're lovable. So the path of growth for them is authenticity. Can you be who you actually are? Can you let people see the parts of you that aren't amazing, that are just average? And know that actually people can love that about you. In fact, what I've discovered as a three is the more I show that to people, the more approachable I actually am, the closer people will draw to me. Because when I stand at a distance and I'm all put together and I'm amazing, it's like I can't relate to that. So threes need to hear your love for who you are. Threes at their best are a reflection of God's hope and his radiance. So I have to point out to you, the first time I saw this first coaching question, what are you willing to just be average at? I had a visceral reaction, like I threw up a little bit. I was like, I feel like you're asking me, like, what do you want to suck at? And that's the thing for threes, it's like, I'm amazing or there's nothing else. Like, average is my F. So there's a lot of pressure that comes in that, right? So questions about, yeah.
What about like high performance cultures? One
of the things that they say in The Road Back to You is that for threes living in America, it's like an alcoholic living above a saloon. There's just incredible pressure. And you know what? For a lot of threes, that works really well for a time, and then it doesn't. You guys watch the show This Is Us?
Yes.
Okay, when... I feel you. When Randall, okay, for those of you who haven't seen it, you need to see it. But those of you who do, when Randall has his breakdown, I'm sobbing, right? But the most powerful thing to me was when his brother came and sat with him in his mess. I was like, oh my gosh. Like, to be loved just where you are, like, that, if you haven't guessed, I think Randall's three. I was like, oh my gosh, that's so powerful, right? And so I think for me as a three, what's been really helpful in moving up in leadership is to have people who really know me and aren't impressed with me as I am. Like, you know, just people who just are like, I love you, Gina, just the way you are. I've seen you fail and I still love you, right? That's so important. So important for us to have that when we're in high performance situations. Yeah.
What would you say is like the difference between
I'm so glad you asked that question. That's such a great question. I'm going to throw threes under the bus a little bit in answering this question. All right, so here's what I would say is the difference. Ones have a standard of perfection that applies to everyone, right? Threes have individual perfection. What is best for me? So here's the thing. As a three, this is going to sound awful, but as a three, if you don't meet my standard of perfection, awesome, because then I look better. It's not as hard for me to look the best, right? I don't care if you don't meet my standard. It's because it's just for me. It's not for everyone. Right? That's one big difference. I would say also that a big difference is how they approach problems, because ones tend to think there's one right way to do something. Threes are like, whatever it takes to get me to the end. If I have to try something different, they're a little more flexible that way. They're also much more willing to cut corners to get somewhere, whereas a one's like, nope, this is the way we do it. We got it. If it takes longer, we do it the right way. So that's a big difference. So I feel like my experience is ones are tend to be more detail-oriented, and threes tend to be more big picture. Yeah,
What is redemptive about being a
Oh my gosh. You know what? It's like I said, at our best, right? At our best. We are a reflection of who, some part of who God is, and I think God is awesome, right? He is awesome. He does amazing things. And I think when threes do those things with authenticity, and we do it not to get ourselves ahead, but to say, let's do this together, I think there's an energy, an excitement that draws people in and helps other people be their best too. Yeah?
So I'm a little confused about the wings.
Yes.
So we have two wings now. Like, so what is it?
You can, I would say most people have one or the other.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So as a three, I would have a two wing or a four wing. I know some people who are like, I don't really feel like I have a wing. So I tend to think of it like this. Rather than being like a point on this circle, you're like a range that kind of like can dip to like, you know, like I dip really heavily towards the four. So, you know, my friend Colin, he's a three, but he's got a two wing, so he kind of goes the other direction. Does that make sense? So I think some people are like maybe kind of squarely on their number, and so maybe they draw a little bit from both sides. That's my assumption when people say, I don't feel like I have a wing. That's, yeah. Does that make sense?
Answer your question. So how does it change, like, how you would read, like, your description? Like, okay, so.
Right, so I would just say, oh, well, there's some things that, like, for example, the fact that one of the things that didn't resonate for me is that threes are unemotional, because you ask my husband, I'm a very emotional person, and I think that's probably part of my four wing, because fours are like, they are their emotions. So, yeah, so I think that that's probably where I live out that part of myself. So I think if you go, okay, well, I probably, I'm living out these behaviors. Yeah.
So would it mean that the kind of reset things could also fall into that?
Yeah, I mean, like for me, yeah, to some degree I identify with the root sin of a four, the root need. One thing that's been really helpful for me in understanding, like identifying that, because I used to go back and forth, maybe I'm a four with a three wing. On the Enneagram Institute website, you can sign up to get what's known as an Enneathought. It's a daily email, and you can tell them what number you are, and you can actually sign up for two. So I get three and four. So every day I get an email that has just a couple sentences. It's a thought of like, today, think about this about your number, you know, and see if you can observe this in yourself today. So that's been helpful because I found like most of the time I resonate with three and not four, but sometimes, it, you know, so that can be a helpful way to figure out what your wing is. Yeah.
Just my question earlier, mm-hmm. You said the higher you are, the more self-aware, higher on what?
Maturity. Like the more mature you are. Okay. So like I said, if you were to get this wisdom of the Enneagram, for each number it has, it lists out the nine levels of maturity and gives a quote description for them. So you can be like, oh, look at me, I'm right in the middle, or whatever. So. Okay, let's move on, and then if you guys have more questions at the end, we'll come back. So number four, the individualist. Romantic artist, melancholy. So their basic need is to be special, to be different, to find themselves. There's a basic fear that they have no identity or personal significance. So their lens is that they need to be special, to be noticed and wanted, and that something is wrong about them. Something's missing. So they wrestle with a lot of dissatisfaction. They feel like something is missing in their lives. They don't like mediocrity, superficiality. They're suspicious of the overly optimistic. They're attracted to the offbeat, the avant-garde, and they tend to wait for inspiration to do life. They like to, when they get inspired, they can be very creative and they can produce a lot. And while they try to be special, they also feel left out and different. So at their best, they're highly creative, empathetic, sensitive, self-aware, highly intuitive, able to communicate profound truths about humanity. At their worst, despairing, moody, self-focused, self-conscious, melancholy, over-identify with their emotions, withdraw from others, feel exempt from ordinary ways of living. Their root sin is envy. They envy the normalcy, happiness of others, and it blinds them to what they have. The path of growth for them is self-acceptance, seeing what God has given you, seeing that he has actually made you whole and good and that your identity is in him, and he's actually gifted you. I have a good friend who's 4, and she's wildly gifted, but she doesn't see herself that way. She's always like, oh, but you're so good at this. Oh, but you're so good at this. So 4s need to hear, you're already extraordinary. You are complete and accepted in Christ. Is my microphone still on? Okay, good. At their best, they are a reflection of God's creativity and his depth. So here's some things to think about for 4. This is crazy. I feel like it's like paparazzi. any questions about 4? Yeah.
Is this the path of integration for 2, correct?
Yes, this is a path of integration for 2. So when a 2 is healthy, they can take on some of the positive traits of a 4. Yeah,
it's not specifically about a 4, but I'm just wondering, do you tend to be friends with someone who's your same type, or are you drawn to other numbers that you're romantically or as friends?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's different for everybody. Like, my daughter doesn't like 8s. Sorry if you're an 8, but they scare her. I know that. Even though, my friend Colin, I'm thinking my left, I actually a lot of times have a hard time being friends with other 3s because I get really competitive with them. But that can be true. I think it depends on who you are. Yeah.
What does the line of disintegration look like for a type 4? It goes to the 2, right?
So 4 disintegrates to 2. And what that looks like, they can become really clingy. And they want assurance of the relationship, and they're very, very needy. Yeah. 4 disintegrates to 2. Yeah. Yes, Ross.
So I'm on a 4.
Yeah.
And in one of the books I hear, it's called The Romantic, which I think I probably prefer to the individualist. And as somebody who consciously thinking about community and craving community, guess I'm confused why we would be the number that are labeled the individualist. That makes me think I'm a or alone, but want to succeed on my own side.
Right. Well, I think the individuals come from that idea of wanting to stand out and be different and be special in some way so that you're unique. But that uniqueness can kind of make them feel set apart out of the group and not feel sense of belonging. So it's almost like, I feel like each number kind of has a self-sabotaging thing, and I feel like that's what it is for the 4. You want to just be like, no, you're part of the group, come on, here, you know. So I don't know if that answers your question, but yeah. Okay, last question about 4, and we'll move on.
So are there certain types that are more indicative of firstborn, middleborn, last?
You know, I don't know. I haven't really made a clear observation of anything like that in my experience. I haven't read anything. I think probably that's probably another thing that would make you resonate with a number that might be your own. Not, you know, if you're an oldest child, you're probably going to resonate with one because they're responsible, that kind of thing. All right. Let's move on to 5. The investigator, experts, thinkers, radicals. There was a basic need to know, to be capable and competent. Basic fear of being overwhelmed by the world, depleted of sufficient resources. So they don't want to look foolish and uninformed. So their lens is that they will be safe and protected if they're perceptive and well-informed. They experience the world as very intrusive and overwhelming and draining, so they withdraw into their minds where they feel more at home and competent. So their focus of attention is on what makes sense. They're very practical in their thinking. At their best, insightful, curious, concentrated, innovative, visionary pioneers, experts in their field, able to see the world in a new way. Like, think like Einstein. Right? They're generally the smartest person in the room. At their worst, eccentric, high-strung, intense, isolate themselves from reality, emotionally detached, obsessive over their ideas and thoughts, and can act intellectually superior. Their root sin is avarice or greed, which again is one of those ironic ones because fives tend to be the most minimalist. But I like to think of it as hoarding. They tend to hoard knowledge, information, ideas as a defense against feeling inadequate. And they hoard their emotions and their energy so that they're not overwhelmed. So a path of growth for them is openness. Trusting that there's enough of them to go around, that if they put themselves out there, they're not going to be overwhelmed, and actually they need to put themselves out there and be more comfortable with depending on others. Fives need to hear that if they give, they will receive, rather than being overwhelmed. And they need to learn to believe in abundance. God is a God of abundance. Fives at their best are a reflection of God's wisdom and his knowledge. So here's some thoughts for fives. Any questions? Yeah, back one.
Can you explain the difference between a five and a one?
Just between a five and a one. There's another triad that where one, three, and five are in a triad together, and they have issues because they all like to feel competent, right? But for fives, the competence comes from what they know. I think for ones, it's more of a competence of like I'm doing the right thing. So there's a right way of living. I don't think fives are very out of the box thinkers. Ones are very in the box. Like there's a black and white, very clear. Fives like to kind of test the waters. They're like, ooh, let's think. You know, they're like kind of people who like to engage in intellectual conversations because there isn't like a right, one right way kind of thing. So I would say that's a big difference. Any other questions about fives?
Don't fives just gather information because they just love it? One, they're more like, we get to the point where this isn't practical or something.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
I don't want to.
Yeah, there's a bit. Yeah, ones are very pragmatic in that sense, and yeah, fives kind of they can kind of keep going and not know what where the end should be. Yeah.
I was gonna say two things. One is someone who identifies as a five. You didn't show it up there, but it's in the quick reference guide. Mm-hmm. One of the fears of being useless or helpless.
Yeah.
Like for me, being on life support would be horrible. Like if I'm in that state, might as well just pull the plug. Like I don't want to be like I'm helpless and I'm useless.
Mm-hmm.
But then like on the other side, like just gathering all like I listen to like 20 different podcasts. Like if that's you, like you may be a five.
But you might be a five, right? Yeah, my brother's a five and he has an undergrad, two masters and a doctorate. I'm like, what have you done? How much do you know? Yeah. Alright, well, let's move on to six. Sixes are the loyalists, also known as the doubters, the guardians, and troubleshooters. I like to call them the skeptical loyalists because my son is over here, he's a six. Because before they are loyal, they will question everything. Whether it's a person or an organization, they will question everything. So there's a basic need to be secure and supported, a basic fear being without support or guidance. So their lens is that they have to do their duty and follow the rules in order to be secure and avoid harm and punishment. They see the world as an unsafe place, so they're always planning for worst-case scenarios. They tend to depend heavily on others for guidance rather than trusting their own judgment. So at their best, they are reliable, hardworking, responsible, trustworthy, deeply loyal to family, friends, groups, and causes. They're great troubleshooters. They courageously champion themselves and others. At their worst, fear-driven, pessimistic, stubborn, suspicious, and insecure, they can be cautious and indecisive, but also defiant and rebellious. The root sin is fear. And we all of us can struggle with fear, but for sixes, it's like a vague anxiety, like this kind of free-floating anxiety that they might not even be able to actually tell you what they're afraid of. It's just something bad might happen. So the path of growth for them is faith and also confidence. You know, to have the confidence to say, I'm going to step out, even though I might not know everything, even though something, you know, scary might happen. I think that sixes need to hear that the story ends well. I would love to tell sixes that God is safe, but he's not safe. He's good, right? And he is with us, and he will support us. So sixes are a reflection of God's faithfulness and his commitment to us. I mentioned at the beginning that ones have an inner critic. Sixes have an inner committee. I like to think of it like Inside Out, you know, how she's got the, like, fear and anger, but it's all fear. They're all fear. And they're like, this could happen, and this could happen, and this could happen. And so this whole, like, just constantly questioning what could happen, what could happen. So questions about six. Yeah. Yeah.
Is that true, and why do you
think that is? I don't know why it's true, but in my observation, especially, here's the thing that I find it interesting. The teams that I've done at CRU, a number of them have a good number of sixes, but they're the older staff. And I think it's because they've stuck around, right? They're the lifers. I think by the end, like when we get the people who've like been on for 50 years, they're all gonna be sixes. They're like, for the long haul. Yeah, I don't know why that is, but I have observed that. Yeah.
Necessarily about sixes, but you keep saying like your kids, you like you know your kids. I don't know how old your kids are, but how did they how do they process that?
Yeah, my kids like self-typed by age 10, like secondhand smoke, just listening to me talk about it. I don't know. I haven't really read anything that's like, here's a good age to know. I think some kids it's just like obvious. They're just like, wow, that kid's a 7, right? I would say this. I would not talk to your child. If you figure out what you think your kids are, don't talk to them about it, because I think it can become a self-identifying thing for them. But I think it's a good thing to understand. Because I look back on my kids and I go, oh, that thing that I thought was willful disobedience was my son being terrified because I was asking him to do something he didn't understand. And he hadn't been able to question yet, right? So I think it helps us understand our kids' motivations. I think when kids get to be like maybe 10 or 12, I think they start to realize like life isn't as easy as they thought it was. And their stress behaviors come out a little more. And I think that's when it starts to be a little easier. There are some books on the resource list that are specifically for parenting that are helpful. So, yeah.
Like with all of these types, I think I'm pretty sure I'm a 6. But can the way the environment you're raised in like have an effect? Like my dad was in law enforcement, mm-hmm. So I was taught, I think my whole life, like you gotta watch out for this, you gotta watch out for that. And I wonder.
Right. I don't think that you're. I would say, from what I read, your environment does not make you your type. You are born that, and that's the lens through which you see the world. And so the lens through which you saw the world was, I see the unsafe things my dad is helping me understand, you know? So if, as a 3, I would have seen it differently. I do think that it shapes particularly our maturity level and the you know, just the degree. Like, I think, you know, my husband is a 9. I'm talking about my husband. My husband's a 9, and we're recently trying to figure out what his brother is. And I keep thinking, I think he might be a 7, but I think what it is that my husband and his brother were raised by a 7. And so they do kind of 7-ish things because that's how they were taught to see the world, right? Even though they have a different lens. So I think it does affect you somewhat, but I don't think it changes your number. Yeah.
Is the millennials, would you describe them as a cup is half empty?
Yes, they tend to be pessimistic. Yeah. Okay, let's move on because I want to get through the next few and have time for questions. They have other things to talk about. So, 7s are the enthusiasts, energizers, generalists, multitaskers. They need to be satisfied, fulfilled, or to have fun. The basic fear of being deprived and in pain. So they think that they will be satisfied and happy if they stay busy, enjoy the pleasures of life, and keep a positive outlook. They want life to be fun so they can avoid pain. They don't do anything that brings them down. And they can be escapologists when it comes, if life gets boring, uncomfortable, or scary. They need flexibility, they live for the next adventure, they struggle to linger with anything negative. So at their best, joyous, satisfied, high-spirited, practical, optimistic, versatile, spontaneous, life of the party, they focus their talents on worthwhile goals. At their worst, scattered, frenetic, gluttonous, impulsive, overextended, undisciplined, they can become distracted and exhausted by always being on the go. So the root sin of seven is gluttony, which is not necessarily related to food, it can be, but it's just an insatiability, like I want more fun things and I want new things, and it's an effort to stay above suffering and inner turmoil. So if they can just stay above that. So the path of growth for them is contentment and sobriety. They need to learn how to slow down, to live in the present moment, to find joy in the ordinary, and to embrace suffering. Sevens need to hear that God will take care of them. They have a tendency to, they've learned how to rely on themselves. And that he is God of any darkness that they encounter. He is God in the deepest suffering. At their best, they are a reflection of God's joy and abundance. So questions about sevens? Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting, the eagerness to go and do a bunch of different things.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard it described as like the millennial generation and a lot of that generational patterns.
Yeah.
Do you see generational patterns or communal patterns in these types?
I don't know. Yeah, I've heard the same conversation though, that it feels like millennials are like a whole generation of sevens. I have a girl that I coach who's a millennial, and she's struggling to decide if she's a three or a seven, because she's like, yeah, but I love all this adventure and fun and whatever, so it can be a little confusing. Yeah.
So sevens go to a five in health, right?
Yep.
What does that look like?
Yeah, I'll give you an example. I knew a girl a long time ago, and she was a seven. When I first knew her, she was really unhealthy, and she was very scattered, very frenetic. And then she went and she did a lot of personal growth, a lot of healing. And when she came back, she was someone, she's got all these things that she's interested in, right? But she had learned that there are a couple things that she was really passionate about. And she had learned how to really focus her energies on those things. So she's still got the same amount of energy, but she's learned to like hone in, just like a five, because the fives are like experts on one thing, right? So I think it's a really powerful thing when you see a seven do that, to just really, like, I'm not going to try to be a master or a jack of all trades, I'm going to be a master of something. Yeah, it's a really powerful thing. Okay, let's move on so we can get through everything. Type eight, the challenger, leaders, protectors, rocks. There's a need to be against, to protect themselves, to be in control of their own lives. A basic fear of being harmed or controlled by others. The lens that they have is that they have to be strong and invincible in order to survive in a world where the powerful take advantage of the weak. They tend to be intimidating, but they don't see themselves that way. That's just the energy with which they move in the world. They believe that life is a battlefield. They really actually enjoy a good fight. They like to take charge, and they tend to believe their viewpoints are irrefutable. So at their best, self-mastering, self-confident, heroic, generous, protective, resourceful, straight-talking, and decisive. They use their strength to improve others' lives. At their worst, egocentric, intimidating, controlling, confrontational, restless, impatient with inaction, shut down emotionally. They have problems with their tempers and with being vulnerable with others. The root sin of an eight is lust, which, again, this is not simply a sexual thing. It's an intensity. It's this lust after intensity. It's sort of an uncontrolled excessiveness. They assert their will against their environment so that they don't feel controlled or betrayed. And that kind of prevailing can become an addiction. So the path of growth for them is tenderness and vulnerability. The word vulnerable means to be wounded or to be able to be wounded. And that's actually, it actually requires a great deal of strength to be vulnerable. And that's really important for eights to think about. The fact that God is a very vulnerable God is, I think, a good path for eights to think about. What does that look like? Eights at their best are a reflection of the power and protectiveness of God. So here's some tips. I want to say this. An observation I've made about eights in crew or in ministry in general is can be a really hard thing, especially for women, because we don't often make space for women who are really strong leaders. We don't make space for commanding leaders like this. But I know some eights in my life who eights, when they integrate, they take on the positive traits of a two, and they become very tender, very caring. And my boss is an eight, and I feel eights, what they tend to do is they tend to create a sort of an inner circle of people that they protect. And when you're in that circle, I feel like I'm in that circle with him, and I feel I've never felt more valued by a boss ever. I feel like he's got my back. And that's a really powerful thing that eights can give to people. The way that they protect other people is really amazing. Any questions about eight? Yeah.
Does five integrate to eight? Or does
yes. Okay. Five integrates to eight. Yeah, good question. Yeah.
How can an eight and a nine wing?
Yeah. Happen? It's not really common for eight to be eight with a nine wing or a nine with an eight wing because they are so very different.
Yes.
The way I think I maybe. I'm trying to figure out if I know an eight with a nine wing. I would say they're a little more subdued than an eight with a seven wing. Most of the eights I know have a seven wing. But yeah, I think there's just, they're kind of like a gentle giant kind of sense to them. Yeah.
So if, like, this is the direction of disintegration for a two.
Yes.
Correct.
Yes.
So I'm fairly certain I'm a two, but I'm very non.
Yeah.
I do see ways that, like, when I'm, you know, in disintegration, I shut down and I kind of hover down, but I don't, like, see conflict, like, ever.
Right.
So, is like, how does that...
The way that I see twos disintegrate, it usually happens when they've been feeling unappreciated. They'll just suddenly be, like, they'll kind of lash out. And they'll get demanding, and they'll be like, I can't believe you didn't, you know, do this for me. And it's kind of surprising because it's so contrary to the typical behavior of a two. So it's not necessarily that they become... like this demanding, but it's just a kind of a more, they become more vocal and more willing to say what they're feeling, but in a negative, not a helpful way.
For some reason, I'm having a hard time seeing the difference between a two, or a three and an eight.
Yeah, okay. So the difference between a three and an eight, threes are much more image conscious than eights are. As a three, if someone's upset with me or doesn't think that I did something well, I'm very distressed. Eights are like, hey, if you have a problem with me, I don't care. I mean, it's for them, it's about I'm strong, I'm exerting my strong position. If you don't like it, that's your problem, it's not my problem. So they don't have the same image consciousness so two, three, and four are part of a triad that they're very image conscious. Like I said, eight, nine, and one are a different triad. Yeah. They're very energetic. They love life, and they're like, there's kind of like they work hard and they play hard, and it's like 150% on everything. There's just a lot of them. Okay. What do eights need to hear? I would say eights need to hear that. Actually, I didn't read this. I'll tell this. Eights need to hear that true connection is going to elude them unless they let their guard down. Unless they learn to be vulnerable with others. And that God is a vulnerable God. That to be like him means that they have to choose to be vulnerable. Okay, I want to move on really quickly. If you have other questions, you can pull them. So type nines are peacemakers, comforters, reconcilers, utopians. They have a basic need to be at peace, to have inner stability, basic fear of loss or separation. Their lens is that they have to be calm and go along with others in order to be connected and comfortable. They feel like their presence, priorities, and desires matter less than others, and they tend to fall asleep to their emotions, particularly to anger. They lose touch with what they want and who they are. At their best, gentle, patient, approachable, accepting, optimistic, supportive, and unselfconscious, they're able to bring people together and heal conflicts. At their worst, passive, keep the peace at all costs, numb to life, comfort-seeking, and inattentive. They can oversimplify problems, minimizing anything upsetting, and be passive-aggressive. So the roots in is sloth, which is not necessarily laziness. My husband works harder than anybody I know, but it's a desire to not be disturbed. So I always think of Shifu from Kung Fu Panda when he's like, inner peace, inner peace, inner peace. They're slothful at paying attention to their own lives and what they want. They tend to ask little of life and hope that life returns the favor. The path of growth for them is to be presence, to wake up, to say yes, to make your desires known, to draw the lines in the sand, to know that they have something that they bring to the table that's worth offering, and stop drafting behind other people. Nines need to hear you are seen, and what you have is important. God gave you gifts. He gave you opinions. He gave you things that you need to share. You have a place at the table, and you need to insert yourself in it. Nines are a reflection of God's peace and his oneness. Okay, so question about nine. Yeah.
Hypothetically, if a nine was married to a four, then it would come
to
my career this way.
Right. I would say this. I could answer questions like that all day. There's a great book called The Enneagram in Love and Work. It takes every number and compares it to every other number in terms of what they're like in relationship and what they're like when they work together. It's a super helpful resource. You can also find some of that information on the enneagraminstitute.com.
What's the book called?
The Enneagram in Love and Work. Yeah.
So a nine is most likely, if they have a wing, to have a one wing?
A one wing, or it's possible to have an eight wing. I know someone who's a nine with an eight wing, and it's kind of funny because she's like super easy going, and then all of a sudden she'd be like super fierce. Where'd that come from? But yeah, most nines that I know have a one wing. It's just more, it goes together more easily, I think. Any other questions? Okay.
What do they need to hear again?
They need to hear that they're seen and that their presence matters. What they have to offer is important. Okay, so let me get to this. So what does growth look like? So what do we do with this information, okay? So the first thing I would say is we need to learn to be self-aware. So whether it's the Enneagram or something else, we need to be people who are willing to ask, what's going on in me? What is being stirred in me? And why? What's happening in me? So taking the time to observe our own behavior. Why did I respond like that? What am I trying to get? So I'll give you an example. We lived overseas for 13 years, and we got a dog the last year that we were there. My husband left for 12 days when we got her. She was only 6 weeks old when we got her. And I was trying to homeschool my two kids, right? So over the course of the first few weeks that we had her, I found myself becoming a seething cauldron of rage. I was baffled by how angry I was. Why am I so angry? So I stopped to think about it. I thought, well, here's why I'm angry. Because I can't seem to figure out how to train this dog. I'm not homeschooling my children well because I'm paying attention to the dog. My husband's gone. You're going to hate me for saying this, but my maid had quit the week that we got the dog. And when you're living in the country that I was living in, you need a maid to keep your house in order. So my house was a disaster. So basically, I was failing everywhere I looked. And for a three, failure is kryptonite. So I thought, wow, why? I know I don't like failure, but I didn't realize the degree to which I had a hold in my heart. So when we start to, I think anger is such a great emotion to, because it means something feels threatened, right? So I think when we feel anger, it's a great time to stop and go, what's being stirred in me? So for me to have that framework of the Enneagram and go, that's right, I don't like failure. So what I'm going to do to this, I ended up having to go to a counselor. My dog literally drove me to get a counselor. But in the guide that I gave you, there's some other reflection questions that you can use for self-awareness. I would also say this book, Self to Lose, Self Defined, there's a chapter in here. This is my new favorite Enneagram book. There's a chapter in here that actually walks you through, you just had a weird experience with a friend. What just happened? And you walk through, this is what my Enneagram type says I'm trying to get, and here's what God actually wants me to live in. It's amazing. Self to Lose, Self Defined. I'm going to come back to this in a minute, so don't worry about that. Self to Lose, Self Defined. Second thing, confession. The Enneagram helps me see my sin. And obviously, I need to confess that to God, but I'm also learning that it's really, really helpful for me to confess it to other people. To be I've said to my boss, you know what, I really feel this pull right now to impress you. I just want you to be impressed with me. I find that a lot with leaders. I want them to be impressed with me. Or to say to someone, You know, for a two to say to someone, I really need you right now, you know? Like, that's really important. So to say out loud the things that we're recognizing, like, this is what's being stirred in me. I think it's really powerful for us to say those things. The third thing is to spend time focusing on our foundation. How does God speak to my root fear? What would he say to my root need? You know, that root need in me to be valuable. When we moved back to the States, that desire in me was so strong at times it was a physical ache because I did not feel valuable. No one saw me. No one asked me what I wanted to do. And I had so many sweet times with the Lord just like sitting with him and going, Lord, I know that you think that I'm valuable. I don't feel valuable right now in the world. And that hurts. And so just to be able to sit with that and sit with that grief and not, because my tendency would be to have contempt for it. And I think a lot of times we have contempt for our root need. We're like, why do I want this so much? But just to be like, you know what? God gave me this desire and it's good. It's just a question of am I seeking him for it or am I seeking other people? So to learn to just focus on that and say, yeah, for me to know, I love for who I am. That's been a huge thing. And what I've discovered is that the more I sink into that truth, there's a solidness that grows inside of me that I feel more free externally to act in a way that might be contrary to what I naturally would do. Because I feel like I have a solid place to go back to. The last thing is intentional practice. Like those developmental tips I talked about, the coaching questions, you can find these, like I said, in any Enneagram book. So like I said, when we're focusing on our foundation, there's an internal solidness that can grow. And then when we look at these external practices, I think that internal solidness gives us external courage to act counterintuitively to what we might normally do. So how do you discover your type? This is the question. Okay, you can take tests. If you go online, here's the thing. If you go online and you Google Enneagram, you can find some weird stuff, okay? This is a good website, EnneagramInstitute.com. It's by the same, it's actually a lot of the same information as this book, The Wisdom of the Enneagram. You can, if you're gonna go there, you can take a free test, but I recommend that it's called the RHETI test, R-H-E-T-I. It's $12, I think. But don't take that as conclusive. People have told me, well, I tied on two, so I guess I'm both. No, it's just a starting point, you know, for you to go, oh, okay, I'm probably on one of these numbers. But I've had people take that test and then not be one of the top numbers that they test. And that actually, that takes a great deal of a lack of self-awareness, to be honest. The more self-aware you are, the easier it is to identify your type. But I would say the best thing you can do is just read Enneagram books. The more you read from different people's, you know, different authors' perspectives, and you're kind of, oh, okay, you get a fuller picture of what each number is like. And then you can, you know, figure it out. And I would say ask friends and family to give you feedback. Probably if you're married, your spouse can say, like, yep, that's what you are, sweetie. You know, it's hard. It's hard. We're like, no, I really want to be this number. I thought there was one more. No, I guess that's it. Okay. So, most of the resources that I have shared with you today have come from these three books. The Wisdom of the Enneagram, The Road Back to You, and Self to Lose, Self to Find. I would say if I owned one Enneagram book, it would be this one. Just because it's the most comprehensive. This describes the different wings, it describes integration, disintegration. It talks about stuff I didn't even touch on today, subtypes and triads and all kinds of other stuff. This is the one that I go back to if I have a question. It's called The Wisdom of the Enneagram. It's on the list here. I know a lot of people are familiar with The Road Back to You. This is a great book. It's written by Christian authors, and I laughed and cried out loud when I read this book. It was really, really fun. I think it's a great introduction to the Enneagram. There's also a podcast that they've done where they interview different types, which is interesting. But like I said, the Self to Lose, Self to Find is my new favorite Enneagram book. This is the most biblically based Enneagram book I've read. There's a chapter in here called Invitations from Jesus. Like, it's just, there's prayers for each number. There's like how God would, what he would say to each number. I love it. So because I love these books so much, I'm actually going to give them away to you guys. Not all of them, like all of them. That's not true. But for those of you who are in a scene, seat. If you look under your table, if you have the cover to one of these, then it's yours. So hold it up there. You come up and take a look at mine, or you can come in. You can get them on Amazon, all of them. I want to say this. So I would love to connect with you. This is my Twitter and my Instagram handle, Gina_Butts. This is my website. This is what I talk, this is what I write about on my website. My website's called Awakened because that's what I want us to do, is I want us to be awake. So I'd love it if you guys join me on the journey. There's actually a free ebook that you can get if you subscribe to my blog, and I'm pretty sure I talk about the Enneagram in that book, because I always talk about the Enneagram. The other thing I would like to say is I've done this for teams at our headquarters, where most people kind of like, we know what numbers they are, so we talk about what are those numbers like working together. I did it for the Great Plains Moms Conference. We talked about what each number looks like as a parent and what they look like as a kid. That was a really, really sweet time. So if you guys are interested in something like that, you can email me. I don't have it on here. I'm just gina.butts@crew.org. Or you can get there through my website as well. I'd love to talk to you about helping you with it, something like that. I want to finish with a quote, and then we have a few more minutes, we can have some more questions, but this is from Self to Lose, Self to Find. It's actually a quote from A Tale of Two Cities. She says, "There is the best of me, there is the worst of me. There is the wise me, there is the foolish me. There is the me who believes, there is the me who doubts. There is the me who is in light, there is the me who's in darkness. There is the me who hopes, there is the me who despairs. There is the me with everything ahead, there is the me with nothing ahead. There is the me that looks to heaven. There is the me who looks the other way." This is the tale of two selves. John Ortberg puts it this way: you are your own nemesis, your own biggest problem, because there's a relationship between the best version of you and the worst version of you. And what they have in common is that they're both you. So I think the Enneagram can be a really powerful tool for helping us see, where are we? Where does God want us to go? And how does he want to take us there? How does he want to journey with us?